there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us.
Welcome to Words to Write By! So, yesterday we had our first ever meetup group, our process group.
Yeah, so Bird by Bird is all about process, and we thought it might be a really good idea to revive this process group that Renee started a while back, and we let go, and open it up to anybody that wants to join in.
Yeah, and we got how many people? About 6 people?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was really fun.
Yep, so the plan is to run them on alternating Wednesdays, so either we release a podcast or we get together and do a process group, and it's on Meetup. It's the name of it is
Words to Write By's Process Group.
Right. We're based in Santa Cruz, so if you're far away, you might have a harder time finding us. You might need to change your region.
Well, or better yet, just go to the website. It's on the front page. You'll see a little poster or some girl with her cats.
Yeah.
And you just click on the picture and it'll take you straight to the meetup link. Our next one is March 15th at 5 o'clock.
Yeah. And we'll take some topics from what we've been discussing in the podcast, but also we open up to other things people want to talk about.
Yeah. So the one upcoming will be these chapters we're reading now, which are short assignments, shitty first drafts, and procrastination. Dun, dun, dun.
Perfection.
Sorry. And perfectionism.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
But before that, our last podcast, we discussed the fantasies that unpublished writers have of what will happen when they become published. And Renee and I had some ideas on that, and Lamont had some ideas on that. And I thought that I would check in with an agent who deals with a lot of unpublished writers that are then going on to be published and getting his thoughts on how this all works.
Hi, my name is Eric Hain. I am a literary agent and the founder of Headwater Literary Management. I'm also one of the co-hosts of Print Run Podcast. We cover book stuff and publishing stuff just like you guys. And yeah, I'm excited to be here today. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for coming. It's nice to have someone with this experience to answer some of these questions that we have from this book. In our last podcast, Renee and I talked about our publication fantasies. And in the book itself, Lamont talks about how she had this Hallmark commercial version with wildflowers and acclaim and self-esteem. Do your new writers you sign have publishing fantasies?
Absolutely. The main fantasy is that once you're through the agent hurdle, everything makes total sense and you're done being in a submission pile and all this kind of stuff. I think it comes up because people rightly view getting an agent as such a giant hurdle, right? It's such a hard thing that when you cross that milestone, writers are ready for some relief. They want the next step to be a little bit smoother. And sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. And I always try to just approach each client of mine, you know, as we get ready to go out on submission, and just basically tell them, look, there's so much that is out of your control and out of my control. I mean, we're going to be waiting to hear from people. It might take months. It might take a few days. It's tough to know what to do about it because on the one hand, sometimes it really does go really well. Like, I guess that variability and that waiting can be really hard on writers. And that's the sort of thing that I think cuts into the fantasy.
Mont talks about how she writes about how authors, once they've had their book published, they go through all this uncertainty and all this back and forth. And suddenly there's the book and it's in print. And she says it can be a bit of a letdown because it will not give them the feeling that the world has finally validated their parking tickets. Do your authors ever experience this?
Yeah, I mean, the book coming out, it can be kind of a hard thing because we're conditioned, especially now in the age of the unboxing video and the cover reveal. We are presented with all this joyful feeling anytime a book publishes, right? And the truth is, when you get your finished copy It's a finite object. It comes in an ugly cardboard shipping box from a publisher. You open it up and you're still the same person there standing in your house. And that is something that I talk about with writers a lot. The idea that doing this and reaching this particular point going to fundamentally change your life. I can't say that sometimes it doesn't. I mean, there are people who get deals and have coverage after their book comes out that it really does kind of alter, you know, their work situation, all that kind of stuff. But a lot of the time, it's just the thing that you did. The upfront work on fiction is so enormous. You're setting yourself up for letdown if you expect the moment you're holding it to be like of equal weight. We want this moment of publication to be exciting and, like, you know, the coming out party for you, the brilliant artist. It's weird because it's not that it's not those things. It's just that it might not happen on the scale or the way that you expect. I think, like, all of that is to say, like, the validation has to come from somewhere other than the outside response, because sometimes it's there, sometimes it isn't, but you still did the thing that you set out to do. And that's still incredible, because it is really hard to get to that point for anybody.
So many people have books they want to write, and so few people actually have books they have written.
Yeah, absolutely.
So here's the question. As you're talking about, you need to find validation outside of the physically published book and all the uncertainty that goes into the process of getting an agent. Once you get an agent, of getting it published, there are other options now with the internet for people to get that fast recognition and an audience. People could self-publish books. They could serialize their books. They could write blogs. So what healthy reasons are there to go the agent publishing house route?
I would say that the fundamental one is the support system that you get. Because when you're doing those other things, which, as you point out, do work for a lot of people. I mean, the self-publishing model or the other forms where you have complete control, you sort of become the entire publisher of your book. And you're not just putting things online, right? Like, you have to edit. You have to find a way to edit the book. You have to find a way to get the thing made. You have to front different costs. You have to figure out a way on your own with your own resources to market and publicize it. And the thing that I think traditional publishing still offers is people to help you do that. Having a devoted publicist who has a relationship with whatever outlet you're interested in, I mean, that really matters. And that can make the difference in a book that sort of comes and goes in terms of attention on it, and one that kind of does have a tail and it does generate conversation. And so to me, the traditional publishing route, like, the fundamental reason to pick it over self-publishing right now is just infrastructure around you and a support system that is invested in having you succeed.
Is that support system basically practical? Like, just different people specialize in doing things and they're going to do a better job at it than if you try to do it all yourself? Or is there something more emotional and personal attached to it, do you think?
I would say it's both. I mean, and it depends. Sometimes it's just practical. Like, every single person who works on your book is not going to be your best friend. There are people who you probably aren't going to have a whole lot of personal contact with. But on the flip side, some of the most meaningful publishing relationships I know that I have, and I know that many of my authors have, are with the editor that acquired their book. And that's the person in-house at a publisher whose job it is not only to do all the practical things, but to really make sure that you, the writer, are feeling like you're getting what you need on that more emotional level. There is a certain amount of, I guess you would callously call it, author management, but just like having an actual human relationship with this person who you are asking to do a titanic amount of work. Writers have to do so much now to promote their stuff that I think that it is an integral part of the publisher's job at this point to make sure that a writer feels paid attention to, listened to, their views taken into account on different things. You want there to be a real human back and forth and not just, okay, we're putting you through our system and you're just one more book, which when that kind of thing starts to happen, I intervene and I say, that's not acceptable. It's not what we're doing. And if it keeps up, then I don't go back to that place. I always come back to how much effort the writer has to do in isolation to get a book to that point. I do feel that they are owed the basic human relationship with their editor and even their publisher. And it happens a lot of the time. Like, I remain an optimist about those relationships across the industry. I think it's really special. And I think it's a very good feature of traditional publishing still.
Fantastic. Well, is there anything that you were expecting me to ask you that I did not ask you?
Oh, interesting. That's a good question. You know, maybe it's the question of, myths, right? Like, what's the expectation that immediately gets overturned? What do writers come in thinking that they very quickly find out is not the case? And the thing that I always think is kind of difficult for writers is just the level of engagement with your book is just never going to be as high as it is for you. You know, like even with an editor who does a very careful job of editing the book, someone who really took the time and worked through it, they still don't know it like you know it. You're still the person who made this. And sometimes I know it can be frustrating for writers to feel like an editor hasn't, not even just an editor, like a publicist, whoever it is that's working on it at a given moment. Oh, they just aren't grasping this one specific thing about it. You know, I think this particular thing is really sellable about the book, but I'm not seeing that in the copy here, whatever it is. And it's just this fundamental dynamic where you, the writer, have spent who knows how much time in these pages on this book thinking about what this is versus, someone else who has only encountered it recently. You know, even someone who spends a long time working on a book, like it won't be more than a year, you know what I mean? You'll have spent way more time than that. And so sometimes that dissonance in investment can be a little bit frustrating. And again, like rightly so. I mean, it's this emotional attachment to something you've really poured yourself into, but that's something that I do have to kind of work with writers to, I don't want to say come to terms with, but just understand and be able to work within that dynamic as opposed to being down that the editor hasn't spent the same 7 years on the book that you have. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can see that. Well, thank you so much. This was a great interview. And like I said, I've been really enjoying your podcast. So keep up the good work.
Well, I appreciate it. We're really glad you reached out. This was fun.
In this episode, we're covering what Anne Lamott calls the two single most helpful things she can tell us about writing: short assignments and shitty first drafts. And then there's the anti-writing mindset, perfectionism. Let's get discussing.
So first up, we've got the next chapter, short assignments.
Yes. So these are very short chapters. So we can organize them by just basically picking the topic of each one. So short assignments. What does Lamont mean by short assignments?
So it seems as if it's a matter of mental overwhelm. In the very beginning, she says, the first useful concept is the idea of short assignments. Often when you sit down to write, what you have in mind is an autobiographical novel about your childhood, or a play about the immigrant experience, or a history of, oh, say women. But this is like trying to scale a glacier. I thought that was a really great metaphor, because it is. You're like, how am I going to do this? It's so gigantic. It's so big. How am I going to do this thing? And so she says the solution is to do short assignments that add up later to slowly scaling the glacier.
Right. You get a novel written by writing a certain amount every day, and eventually it builds up. I liked, this isn't necessarily to writing, but it applies to a whole bunch of stuff, which is that it's depressing how little you can get done in a day, but it's gratifying how much you can get done in a month.
Yeah. And, going off that, it's pretty clear, especially when you get to the short assignments, all of them require pretty much writing every day. So what we did in the last bonus episode where we had to write every day, looks like we're doing it again.
Which actually I appreciate because while I enjoyed the Bickham and some of the other exercises for improving my writing overall, I'm really glad when I can actually apply it to my big project.
The technical process toggle of books that we've got going on is a really good system.
I also like the phrase here, E.L. Doctorow's comment that writing a novel is like driving a car at night. You can only see as far as your headlights, but you can make out the whole trip that way. When you're writing a story, you can't capture the entire story in your head at one moment, and you certainly can't transfer that entire story in your head down to the page in one go. But you can like focus on just one thing, one interaction, one plot point, one dialogue. You get all those out on paper or on your computer, and you just put them together.
Yep. Like horse blinders, you just put them on the side of your eyes and you can't see. The only thing that you could see is what's right in front of you. So you don't get distracted by the glacier.
Glacier's gonna be really bright.
It's really interesting, like when I was doing a lot of trail running, and when you've got a hill, you're going to be climbing 1,000 feet of elevation, you don't look up. You only look at your feet. Well, and maybe around you, but you look at your feet because if you look up, your body actually gets more winded. It's all more tired because you're like, oh my God, how much further do I have to go? But if you look at your feet, you just step by step, step by step. You could do that one step. Then you can do another step.
Or sometimes when I'm biking, I'll just say I'm going to count pedals until I hit 20. And then I'll count until I get 30. And then by then, hopefully I'll be done with the hill. But if not, maybe I'll count until I'm 40. But
yeah. That's this chapter, essentially, is you do short assignments that then add up to a novel or at the top of the hill or riding your bike 50 miles.
Or just that big hill I have to do when I go to take my son to school in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, and now we're moving on to probably Lamont's biggest contribution to the theory of the writing process.
Shitty first drafts. Bam.
You said that this essay appears in composition books all over the place.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you get a composition reader, a teacher assigns. It's got, you know, 50 essays in it, and this is going to be one of them.
Why do you think that is?
Well, we teach the writing process in our classes. Historically, they did not. Historically, it used to be a professor writing a phrase on the board and then telling students in the class, write me an essay on virtue. And then students would write an essay on virtue and then turn it in, and then it would get destroyed by the professor. It evolved over time, and then I believe it was in the 70s with this guy named Peter Elbow, and also the author who wrote Writing on the Bones. So they argued that writing is like a form of play and that people should be allowed to write as a form of discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Authors have always had a process. I mean, I'm sure Shakespeare had a process. He just wasn't telling anybody what it was. Now, instead of just writing a prompt on the board and making students write, we teach the process. And part of the reason is because students have misunderstanding of the process of writing. They think that good writing is fast writing. And, yes.
And short writing.
And short writing. They have this image in their head of the writer who just knocks it out and it's done. That's what writing is. The good writer is the one that writes quickly. Everything that flows out of their fingertips onto the keyboard is magic and perfect. And that's not the case. And so we don't want students turning in first drafts of their assignments. We want them thinking a little deeper because the writing would be pretty bad on the first pass around. So when teaching the process, you teach outlining and then free writing and all that stuff. And then you go, okay, then you write a draft, you bring in the draft, then we're going to share the draft, and then you're going to go home and you're going to revise it.
And so the essay shitty first draft basically makes everyone feel better about writing really bad the first time?
I think it's more a matter of convincing them that it's going to take multiple drafts and that they're not just going to be done with it. And look, there's this famous author who's written lots of books claiming, yes, you really are going to write a shitty first draft. And no, it's not going to come out very good. Don't feel bad about yourself when it doesn't.
This being Anne Lamont, she does make reference. Not one of these writers writes elegant first drafts. All right. One of them does, but we do not like her very much. We do not think that she has a rich inner life or that God likes her or that can even stand her. Although I mentioned this to my priest friend Tom, and he said you can safely assume you've created God in your own image when it turns out that God hates all the same people you do.
You've not experienced the snark yet of Anne Lamott. You just did.
Whenever you're reading a process book or whatever, there's always somebody that doesn't do it that way and has an easy time. And I like the fact that she acknowledges, yeah, you're going to find one person that's exceptional and you're going to hate that person.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
Okay.
And if you were that person, dear listener, turn us off. We don't want you listening to us. No.
I don't think that person needs to listen to us.
No, yes, they're not listening to us anyway. You know what I really enjoyed in this chapter? Because I think mostly everyone listening to us here knows that you got to write a shitty first draft. Like, you just have to write a draft, and it's not going to come out perfect. And you're not supposed to. But what I really liked was the names that she gave him, right? She called it a shitty first draft, but then she brought in other people that called it something different. Like one person, she said, called it a child's draft. And then another person called it an updraft and a downdraft.
Well, that was the second version of it, was the downdraft.
Right. So the first version, your shitty first draft, is an updraft. And then the second draft is the downdraft. And I thought that was really cool. So I was wondering, do you have a name for your draft? Like, what is a shitty first draft to you? Do you have, like, a nickname for it?
No, I just call it rough draft.
Okay.
Do you?
No, but I could come up with one. I'll call it a panic draft.
Okay.
Yeah.
The term shitty first draft has pretty wide recognition now, not simply from Anne Lamott, but also from the whole NaNoWriMo movement. And that encourages people to write a shitty first draft. That's the central tenet of National Novel Writing Month. And the part that they emphasize is that you have an editor in your head that is going to get in the way when you're trying to write. And they're going to stop you and they're going to make you go back. And you're just going to spend forever on the first three chapters and you're never going to write your novel. And so NaNoWriMo and shitty first drafts are all about turning off that editor and just writing it all out.
Right. That's why you only have a month.
Right.
Right. Because if you had 3 months, you would take the entire 3 months to do it.
And nobody would stick with it for 3 months either.
Right. Anyone can write 60,000 words in a month.
Or that's the idea. 50,000 words in 1 month is the idea.
50,000 words in 1 month.
Or they can attempt it. They get 40,000. That's still pretty good, too. A lot of focus is on just turning off the editor and getting to the end, which is really important. But there's another aspect to Anne Lamott's idea of shitty first drafts. By just writing it out, you're going to tap into some things that you weren't aware of were there. Some amazing things. This is similar to her writing every day, which is that you write a whole bunch of stuff that's not useful, but then somehow or other you get your brain to ping on something that really is good. And so it's not simply I need to write to the end of my story to say that I've actually done it, but that by forcing me to write to the end of the story, I'm going to discover something really fantastic in the middle that I never would have thought about because I was always thinking about the beginning and the end of the stories and never what was going on in the middle. Do you find that within your shitty first drafts that there are gems in the middle, or how do you look at them when you get done?
You know, my shitty first drafts are pretty shitty, but I acknowledge that they're playing. Like, I'm playing and I'm throwing anything at the wall and, you know, noodles at the wall and seeing if they stick. When I was much more prolific and motivated and sitting down and disciplined to write, I had a whole process. I free wrote by hand. And then I typed it up, and then I printed it, and then I annotated the crap out of it, and then I made those revisions, and then I started writing. And I didn't even consider that a draft. I just considered that barfing, you know, just to get something on the screen in front of me. And it kind of guided me, you know, okay, oh, I hit upon a metaphor here. That was kind of cool, and it took me 2 pages to get there. And now maybe I'll run with it, you know, and I figured that out in my annotations.
So that's a bit more elaborate way of getting to it. There is a pleasure in those NaNoWriMo novels, even though at the time you think they're absolutely horrible and you're just looking forward to rewriting every single word that's in it. Sometimes you'll go in there and you'll realize that there's a central idea or even a set of, like, you know, a particular sequence of stuff that's just really good. You would never have gotten to if you hadn't written the whole thing.
Yeah.
So one other part to this section, she talks about the voices in your head that prevent you from writing.
Oh, Lordy. Yes. Quieting these voices is at least half the battle I fight daily.
She talks about first there's the vinegar-lipped reader lady who says primly, well, that's not very interesting, is it? Then there's the emancipated German male who writes these Orwellian memos detailing your thought crimes. And then there are your parents, agonizing over your lack of loyalty and discretion. And then there's William Burroughs, dozing off or shooting up because he finds you as bold and articulate as a houseplant. And so on. And then there are also the dogs. Let's not forget the dogs. The dogs in their pen who will surely hurtle and snarl their way out if you ever stop writing, because writing is, for some of us, the latch that keeps the door of the pen closed, keeps those crazy, ravenous dogs contained. Okay, I didn't quite get the dog part at the end, but all the other stuff made a lot of sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the writing is the coping mechanism. You're desperately writing to keep the voices at bay, even though the voices are yelling at you because you're trying to write. It's this weird back and forth. Do you have any people in your head? Like, what people are in your head? Are they real or?
I think it's kind of the last one. All these books that I read where the words just flow together and they're articulate and nice and they don't overuse words all the time, and everything that my writing, when I write it on paper, doesn't appear to be. And that's the thing that always gets me. That's the thing that causes me to just get really frustrated and not want to look at what I'm writing, because the words being used are so plebeian and basic. So that's one of my hangups. What about you? What's the voice in your head that stops you writing?
It is a teacher I had in my MFA program. I remember after the third week, somebody dropped out. They even said, I'm leaving. This is getting to be too much.
Oh, from the MFA program.
Yeah. And I was thinking the same thing, but I didn't have an escape. Because I was like, well, if I don't finish this, I'm going back to Staples. What do you do with a bachelor's in literature? I'm sure there's lots of things you could do. I just didn't know what they were. It was pretty horrific sometimes. I can hear the criticism. Some of it felt nasty. Of course, I took it personally when it wasn't. And I just hear it. I hear it in my head. And I think, I'm no good. Or I think, oh, they've made a mistake. I shouldn't have been there. Mm-hmm. Right. And this person's trying to find me out.
So is the voice actually criticizing your writing, or is it criticizing your deservingness to write?
They're linked. Your writing is a reflection of your deservingness to write and to be there and to take up somebody's spot. To take up a spot. That's what you're doing, is you're taking it. It's not for you. And that's what I felt like leaving those classes. I don't know. Everyone comes to the page for different reasons. I did it to kind of save my life.
For me, there's no moral element. It's just simply that I'm not writing very well. I'm not writing eloquently. I'm not writing something worth reading. But for you, there's a moral dimension too, that not only are you not writing something worth reading, but that you shouldn't even be there in the first place.
Right.
And that's rough.
Yeah.
I mean, that's way worse than just thinking you can't write.
Yeah. You attach it to your identity and stuff, you know, and then your identity's at stake every time you sit down and you convince yourself it's not very good. Mm-hmm. And then you think, oh, I'm not very good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it goes deep. You know, therapy, dear listener, is not a bad idea.
Well, I think we're going to move from this to the next topic that's called perfectionism. But before we get there, we're going to try something a little new on our account. If we sound a little bit different these days, it's because we're recording from a single microphone, because Renee's microphone died on her.
And we are also in a closet with blankets hung up on the wall.
So anyway, if you look at our webpages at wordstorywritebypodcast.com, you will see a little button or icon for a tip jar. And we're just trying to raise some money. There'll be information there about how much we're trying to raise and what we're going to put this money to for a microphone. And it's just to improve the quality of sound in the podcast, because we understand that, you know, it's frustrating to not be able to hear or to have too much background or something on the recording.
Yeah. When I say we're in a closet, like, we're literally in a closet with wetsuits hanging up and blankets. I mean, we are just two ladies doing this on our own, and a few bucks towards a microphone would be super awesome.
Right. So anyway, that's on the website. And honestly, I like recording in closets. They actually sound way better. But
well, your closet is very cozy.
Yes.
I very much like your closet. I'm not complaining.
Okay, and let's go on to the final chapter, perfectionism.
Perfectionism.
Which is kind of the opposite of shitty first drafts.
It is the enemy of the shitty first draft.
Uh-huh.
She says, I think perfectionism is based on the obsessive belief that if you run carefully enough, hitting each stepping stone just right, you won't have to die. The truth is that you will die anyway, and a lot of people who aren't even looking at their feet are going to do a whole lot better than you and have a lot more fun while they're doing it. That is extremely apt. I really identify with that.
I really liked the comment that she equated perfectionism with tidiness. Tidiness suggests that something is as good as it's going to get. Tidiness makes me think of a held breath of suspended animation while writing needs to breathe and move. I think each person has a guiding principle. For me, I think that's part of it, that, you know, if it's tidy, it's going to feel stilted. And it's not going to go anywhere. And it's never going to be better than just tidy. And I'm aiming for, you know, Architecture Digest.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that. But that's crippling. Mm-hmm. That creates a crippling anxiety. Mm-hmm. And also with perfectionism, it gives you the best excuse. You know, why isn't your work good? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, well, I just haven't made it perfect yet.
Or it gives you the best excuse to go back to chapter one and work more on that chapter one.
And not continue. Mm-hmm. Totally. To never finish.
Yes, to never finish.
I think it was Neil Gaiman who said something like, part of the process or part of the art is finishing. Like, you have to start finishing things because that is where the magic is. Mm-hmm. That's what you really got to aim for, because a lot of people start books and never finish them.
So I have a confession. Often I'm reading a piece of published writing, and I'm reading and I'm saying, this isn't very good.
Oh, I do that too.
This writing isn't very good. Or this plot point isn't very good. Or they really started phoning in at this point. And then I stopped myself and said, yes, Kim, but they finished the book. They wrote to the end. Have you ever finished a book, Kim? No, you haven't. So even if you know that your first chapter outwrites this person's first chapter, this person has more than just the first chapter. They have the whole book and it is published. They got to the end. That's what you need to do. So stop feeling so high and mighty and get back to writing.
I need to put that on a t-shirt or put it on a note card. She didn't say that, but I thought that was a really great thing. It's like, yeah, I do the same thing. I'll be reading going, I can do better than that. Jeez, is that published? And I'm like, well, yeah, it is. And guess what, Renee? You're not. Because you won't get in your butt in the chair and get it done. So yeah, I think that's really good. Thank you, Kim. I appreciate that little kick in the pants.
So do you have any ways to get around your perfectionism? Because we're both perfectionists.
I haven't yet figured that out. I think there's one thing in this chapter I liked that felt very true to me. She called perfectionism like a muscle. She called it a psychic muscle. And what happens was in your childhood, all these horrible things kind of happen to you, and your brain built a muscle wall around it to protect you. And it's perfectionism, or it's manifested in different things. And when perfectionism gets activated, you're flexing that muscle and preventing yourself from working, if that makes any sense. Or should I just read the quote?
Why don't you read the quote too?
The pain from our childhood, the losses and disappointments of adulthood, the humiliations suffered in both, to keep us from getting hurt in the same place again and to keep foreign substances out so those wounds never have a chance to heal. Perfectionism is one way our muscles cramp. In some cases, we don't even know that the wounds and the cramping are there, but both limit us. That made a lot of sense because it's connected to those voices. All these things, like I created this wall around those voices. Well, if I can be perfect enough, if I can make it perfect, I can shut them up.
Or the other way of looking at it is that it's a defense. Like, you don't want to dig into all that stuff that hurts. So you get focused on, well, it's not perfect yet. It's a way of never having to go to that next stage of seeing if your work is actually good enough to be published or good enough to be accepted by other people. If you say, well, it's not perfect yet, I need to keep working on it, it gives you an excuse to keep it hidden to yourself and to never take the next step. It's a defense of not being ready to open up this wound, to actually dig into this stuff by saying, oh, no, I've got to get it perfect before I show it to anybody. I've got to get perfect before I go to the next chapter.
Right.
I got to get perfect before I actually address this really deeper theme that I want to get to. I'll get work on that first chapter.
Right. And so my strategy is to dig into the thing that I'm using perfectionism to combat. Or, you know, I'm looking at not just the wall, but the inside. Like, what's going on? Why do I feel this way when I sit down? And trying to investigate that while I'm writing. And in my writing, and in fact, it's almost taking the shape in my memoir of that is the point of the memoir. It's like, how do I overcome these things? I'm not sure if that's where it will go, but it's starting to look a bit like that. And that's what I'm using the writing for, to unlock those things so that maybe I'm less of a perfectionist and a hoity-toity egotistical one at that. Because sometimes I look at stuff and I'm really mean in my head. And now I'm realizing that's just not nice.
My technique's much more basic. I was running a perfectionist when I was first starting to write news stories and feature articles. I'd gone to college a while back. I had been working for a while. I had kids. And now I was like taking on this, I want to write for serious to actually show people. And it was hard because I had not been doing that for so long. And I was writing a very specific piece too. It wasn't like I was writing a novel where you back and forth on that first chapter and all that other stuff. And people say, well, it's nice, but they can't see the whole thing. So, it's good. But this was like an entire story, 1500 words, and it had to be there. And I was just hitting a wall. Like I was spending hours and not having anything to show for it. And I did this one crazy trick. That's when I first started writing stuff in a notebook. In pen. And what I discovered was when you're writing in pen, you can't delete. You just cross it out. And so I just started writing stuff down. When I didn't like it, I'd cross it out and keep going, but it was still there. And it was amazing how often I went back and said, well, that thing underneath that line, that's not so bad. I think I'll just rewrite it out, maybe just change a word or two. The fact that I was writing on ink forced me to actually see what I was writing. And I think confronting what I was writing, I realized it wasn't so bad, or I could do something with it. Or if nothing else, I had a deadline coming up and this is what I had written, so I better get into shape.
All right.
Which is why I continue to write in longhand. And I think it's a self-reinforcement where now the ideas I can have come out of my head when I'm writing with my hand, I write on paper much better than I write and I type.
Yeah. In college, I used to type everything and I started on the computer and now I've moved on to handwriting and I've been doing that for many years now. It allows you to think slower mm-hmm. and therefore sometimes better. Mm-hmm. It allows me to make more mistakes and forgive myself because it's like, well, I'm just free writing. My problem is never going back. I write it down and then I never think to reread it ever again. And that's not good because I need to use the stuff. Mm-hmm. I just write it to throw it away. That's the problem with morning pages. And the great thing about the last activity we did is you are writing specifically to keep things.
Yeah. As writers, we have to believe that our writing is valuable, even if it's a shitty first draft, even if it's not very good. The alternative is to imagine that you actually waste an entire morning doing nothing of any purpose whatsoever because you're not going to look at it anymore. And on some level, if you want to value yourself as a writer, you have to say there is something good in there. I just need to look and find it.
Right. So Anne Lamott's strategies are interesting here. And I want to take a moment to talk about this. God makes its way into this book. And as we mentioned in the previous episode, she has a lot of books on faith. And then she starts talking about that faith in God and says that if you believe in God, you can kind of have a conversation with God and know that God's going to hook you up and help you write that draft today, even though you don't want to or whatever. That's paraphrasing, obviously. And then she gives us another paragraph that says, if you don't believe in God, she said to remember this line from Ganeen Roth. That awareness is learning to keep yourself company and then learn to be more compassionate company as if you were somebody you are fond of and wish to encourage. And I thought to myself, am I fond of myself? I don't know. I like to think I am. I get really excited and I have lots of fun, but I don't know. But you hang out with me, Kim, so I think that means that I can be fun.
You are absolutely fun. Okay. But seeing that in oneself is not easy. It's very easy to build up patterns where you don't see that in yourself. Sometimes we have educational experiences or experience with other people that kind of make it really, really hard. And I think that's a bit beyond the scope of this book and this podcast.
Yes, a bit. But hey, we go there. We're having a conversation. I think it's weird that it makes its way in here. This God thing. It's like, why is religion part of this? I mean, it's a part of her, but it still seems weird to me that it's in this book.
I don't know. I mean, I think of all the times that I basically call on my meditation training to explain things or to use analogies. I think
is what it is. But I'm glad she gave an option for those who are not religious that they're also they can also make use of this book. That's important.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate that, Miss Lamotte.
Let's move on to our exercise.
So there is one strategy she provided in the chapter short assignments. And she says that she has a 1-inch picture frame. And to figure out a 1-inch piece of my story to tell, one small scene, one memory, one exchange. So when she's, you know, filled with self-doubt and those voices are really loud and she's kind of exhausted from the whole process of just trying to write and can't, she has a frame on her table, on her desk, and it's 1 inch. She picks it up and goes, I just have to write that 1-inch space and just focus on the one image or focus on the one event. And you're not even going to go into too much detail. Just fill up that inch of space with writing. And so that's what me and Kim are going to do.
And it's going to be a little bit different for each of us. The ideas we have in our heads might not last, but we might change it as goes along. So we'll get back to what worked and what didn't work. But that's the plan. For next week, when we're having a hard time, we're going to write that 1-inch picture frame worth of writing.
And I saw in Kim's notebook, she literally drew an inch.
And it was too small, so I made it a bit bigger.
Okay, so you're going like 1.25 inches?
Yeah, 1.5 inches.
This assignment reminds me of when I would have a big stack of papers to grade, and I didn't want to. And that's why, you know, you just avoid them until you can't avoid them anymore. And so I would write in my planner, I would write grade 1 paper. Because I knew if I graded 1 paper, I would start grading more. But I couldn't write grade papers in my planner because I would be like, no, I'm not going to do that.
Gave yourself the out that if all you did was grade 1 paper, that'd be fine.
Mm-hmm. And it worked every single time. And so this to me is very similar. Maybe I will get a picture frame or something that's 1 inch big. And I'll know that if I fill that inch, I can be done. But chances are I will continue to write afterwards.
But if you decide you're done, that's okay too.
Yes.
Because it really doesn't count if you say, I'm going to write 1 inch, 1 inch thing, and then I'm going to write more afterwards, because then your brain's like, no, I'm not going to write anything.
Yeah, you're cheating at that point. Your brain's like, I know you.
I'm not dumb.
You're dumb, I know. Anyway, so that's what we're going to do for a whole week, or like call each other up and say, hey, did you write your inch, or are we going to combine this with the last one where we have to write for a half hour and we start with the inch?
No, because then it doesn't count, because then it's the opposite, saying you have to write more than just that 1 inch if you have to write for half an hour. Let's do it for at least 5 days.
Okay.
And then we will get together and see how it worked and what didn't work.
Okay.
We're going to test it out and thoroughly test drive this idea and see how we can make it work for our own writing.
Okay.
All right, then. And we're back after our writing exercise. We're going to talk about how it went for Renee.
How it went for me? Mm-hmm. Me first?
You first.
Oh.
We'll save mine for the bonus podcast.
Okay. It went really well.
Okay.
It wasn't always motivating, but I felt it really did tap into this chapter feels like an unscalable mountain. But the inch just helps me go, look, I only have to write an inch and I only have to write an image. And that was really helpful. It was like almost like a window, like I could see and peek through and see a piece of what I was trying to do. And I slowly went up the mountain.
Did you do an inch every day then?
Yes.
And was it actually an inch or was it a bit?
I took my phone. So not the long way up, but the short way, I guess the width mm-hmm. of the phone. And I put it on my piece of paper and then I drew lines to make it the same size. So, you know, her book was published, what, in the 90s? Mm-hmm. Anne Lamott's book was published in the 90s. So they didn't have these kinds of phones back
no,
then.
No, they did not.
Right. And so she had a frame. She has a 1-inch picture frame. Everyone, though, has a phone now.
And they always have it with them.
Right.
And it is really just the perfect size.
It sure is the perfect size. I mean, it's not 1 inch, right? I think ours is like 1.5 inches.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But if you just look at your phone and be like, I need to write the space of my phone.
Yeah, just that much. Think of it as one step or a couple of steps up that unscalable mountain. And although it's only a couple of steps, it's still more than what you had before.
I think one of the key things here, she doesn't say I had this 1-inch rule. She says she actually has a 1-inch picture frame. So it's like that visual cue. That is what I need to do. And it's sitting right there. And the great thing about using your phone is that is what you need to do. It's sitting right there. There's not this like, well, maybe I may need to go out and grab a measuring. No, it's just like, put the phone down, draw around it, mm-hmm. fill it in.
Exactly. Now, I would also suggest taking your phone after that point and hiding it somewhere, like under a book. And they've done studies, and I've shown this to my students. They've done studies to show that if you can see a phone, if it's just within eyesight, it distracts you by up to 20%. And that totally works for me. So what I usually do is if I'm working while writing, I will take my phone and I'll put it under a book. I can't see it anymore. And suddenly my brain isn't distracted as much as it was before.
So after you did your cell phone worth of writing, did you write more after that?
Sometimes I did. Sometimes I didn't. Sometimes it was just like, okay, I checked off my daily writing. You know, I had an idea in my head as I wanted to do a thing, right? Mm-hmm. And I was really like, I have this idea in my head of what I want it to be and what I want it to look like, which is kind of a trap, right? It's a trap. When your brain starts coming up with a shape and all these things of what you want the book to be, it's never going to meet that expectation.
But a book's a big thing.
A book's a big thing. But for me, just a chapter is a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, okay, I need to scale this chapter. I might have this idea of what I want it to look like and all these things, but if I think too hard on it, the mountain becomes even taller and I'm never going to scale it. So this made it so like I didn't have to think. It said, you know what? Don't overthink your chapter. Just write the inch.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even have to look up at the mountain.
Right. You just have to remember this one boulder here, or this one informative plaque about this tree that's no longer here.
I think I said this years ago to somebody, the process of writing feels a lot like a 3D printer, you know, like it goes back and forth and it builds over time until you have this final draft. So you just keep adding more layers and more layers and more layers with each revision, with each draft until it's done. To me, with every of these inches, I'm like stacking them.
Mm-hmm.
The little printer is going back and forth.
When you look at the stuff you did write for your daily 1-inch writing, is it actually stuff you can use in your book?
Yes. I made sure to not just do free writing.
Mm-hmm. But is it the final version or close to the final version of what it is, or is it completely rewritten?
This is going to get rewritten. I mean, some stuff I'll probably keep, but it definitely has to be rewritten. I don't know if I've ever kept anything exactly the way it was when I wrote it on paper.
So really what this is it forces you to do something every day. It's a task that's doable. And it's something that will support your book, although maybe not in that particular format.
Yes. One problem I had was I would free write every day and I would never reread any of my old stuff. Mm-hmm. Even though there might have been good stuff in there, I never go back and reread it. I have tons and tons and tons of pages of writing that I'll never read. But when there's a box around it, for some reason, I will reread it. And something about boxes, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the animal primate in us. But I have a activity for my students when I teach paragraphs. And I have them write each section of a paragraph in a box. And for some reason, the moment it's in a box, they can do it. Like I just, you know, when you go into Word or Google Docs and then you make a square, it's a table. And I just use tables. I'm like, all right, in this box, write a topic sentence. In this box, write your evidence. In this box, write your analysis. And for some reason, the moment they see it in forms of boxes, they can look at each one independently and they can write each one. And it's easier to write in it. Maybe it's something we've been trained to do since we were in elementary school because everything was workbooky. But I feel it tapping into, like, I'm doing it now, too. I'm like, wow, it's not just for my students, it's also for me, too. It actually works for me. So I was delighted.
Very cool. So we'll call this one a success. And we'll discuss my experiences with it in the bonus podcast. And I think that's our episode. Before we go, what can people listening to this episode do to help support us?
Oh, my goodness. There's lots you could do. But you don't have to do all of them. You can do something as simple as tell a friend. about this podcast and like send them a link to it that you think might be helpful. Hey, I like this episode, you know, and that's all you got to do. You could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. That goes a long way because it puts us up higher in the charts, especially if you liked us. You could support us on Patreon. We have 3 tiers. You could get the bonus podcast of Kim talking about her process and all of our bonus podcasts, to be honest, on the Abby tier, Abby the Fabulous tier, and it's only $3 a month, and that helps cover, you know, upgrades of microphones. It helps cover our Buzzsprout subscription, mm-hmm. Constant Contact subscription for our newsletter. You could get our newsletter, which is free, and that gives you nice updates on things that are going on. And lastly, we just signed up for the Buy Me a Coffee website,
and which we talked about earlier in the podcast.
Oh, we did. So mm-hmm. The tip jar. Yeah.
Yep. So there's that. Okay.
Bam.
Thank you guys so much, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks. Svai Vulcan.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
Hello, and welcome to our... blah, 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 blah.